This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Soon after the GOP lost its last bid to repeal the Affordable Care Act, two Democratic House members, John Conyers and Ro Khanna, challenged representatives to sign on to a pledge supporting a transition to a single-payer or Medicare for All system. Conyers introduced a bill in January for single-payer health care that has drawn backing from 115 representatives so far. But some progressives and liberals are now cautioning against jumping on the single-payer bandwagon. Joshua Holland wrote an article in The Nation headlined "Medicare for All Isn't the Solution for Universal Health Care," where he warns against a backlash to single-payer and suggests there are reformist approaches that might work better. A few days later, Paul Krugman declared in the New York Times, quote, "There are more important priorities," and asked, "Is this really where progressives want to spend their political capital?" Advocates of single-payer have hit back. Among them, Michael Leite of the National Nurses United responded in Common Dreams, quote, "In the name of political reality, some liberal pundits, politicians, and policy wonks are scolding progressives to give up on Medicare for All. They are dead wrong," he says. Today, we'll host a friendly debate slash discussion on whether pushing hard for a transition to single-payer is the right move for progressives. My guests are Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. He's also the host of Politics and Reality Radio, and also Michael Leite, the Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United. Welcome to the program, Joshua and Michael.
Thanks, Sonali.
Thank you, Sonali.
Joshua, let's begin with you. In your article in The Nation entitled "Medicare for All Isn't the Solution for Universal Healthcare," you seem to be making the case that an abrupt transition to single payer would result in a backlash from those people who might lose out, and that a more gradual transition would be better in terms of expanding the pool of those covered by Medicare. So let's start with you taking a minute to summarize your position in your own words for those people who haven't read your article.
Sure. Well, let me first of all just say that the headline is not the headline that I wrote, a little bit more aggressive than I would have framed it. My main concern writing this piece is that it seems to me that we are making, that is, we, the progressive movement, the left, are making a litmus test of a singular approach to universal health care. I'm a very strong advocate of getting to universal healthcare, to getting to something that one might call single payer as well. And that in doing so, we're actually coalescing around what I believe is the most difficult path. And I think that the central problem is that we are talking about compelling 70% of the population or so to switch from their current coverage to something new. And we can tell them that what they're switching to is better, but I think that the central lesson that we've learned from the last couple of iterations of healthcare reform, both by Democrats and Republicans, is that people are desperate not to lose their healthcare. And even if you are promising them something better, that desperation is the central political force in terms of healthcare reform. And we can, I can elaborate that on that afterwards if I've right. used up my.
Michael, let's turn to you next. You wrote in your piece, "Liberals Strike Back Against Single Payer," in that you write that a reformist approach to single payer, quote, "props up and reinforces a profit-focused system that is antithetical to the very concept of healing." So why don't you summarize as specifically as possible your opposition to Joshua's arguments?
Well, we believe that, in fact, the desperation that people feel is precisely why we must pursue an improved and expanded Medicare for All as the way to guarantee healthcare, because it's the out-of-pocket costs, it's the anxiety that really fuels that loss aversion. And I think it's a misreading of it to say that they just want to keep what they have. They are desperate for something that gives them real health security and peace of mind. And that's what an improved Medicare for All offers, because it is the most popular aspect of the system. And I felt like Joshua your article had a series of straw men arguments. No one's saying that this is going to be just a piece of cake, or that we're going to spend what the other countries that started this after World War II will spend. We're not saying this is going to be just immediately an efficient or low-cost system, as Jacob Hacker asserts our position to be. It's not. We recognize that. But the truth is that demand for improved Medicare for All addresses that loss aversion, the anxiety, directly with the most popular aspect of the system. And in fact, Medicare is more popular among Republicans than either the ACA or the any other alternative. So there's a sense among Trump voters, a majority of those earning $30,000 want a federal guarantee of health care. You simply can't guarantee health care if you're relying on the private insurance-based system.
So Joshua and Michael referred to Jacob Hacker, who you quote in your article. He's a Yale political scientist who wrote a proposal, Healthcare for America. Why was that the proposal that you quoted in your article? And also do respond to what Michael just said.
Well, I'd prefer to, the point that I made in the article is that we should have an open discussion without accusing each other of acting in bad faith. Michael suggested that, this is a liberal attack from the empire is striking back, et cetera, et cetera. I want to get past that kind of rhetoric and deal with the substance. Now, I don't think that Michael, who did not even address the issue of loss aversion in his article, understands what this concept is.
Yeah, let's talk about loss aversion. What do you mean by loss aversion?
No. But Michael, you don't, because if you're
I
saying,
do.
Well, you're saying that giving something, offering people something better ameliorates loss aversion. That's not how it works. It's a matter of perception. Michael, if you don't want to take this seriously,
Joshua, explain what loss aversion is.
I don't need this. Honestly, I don't need this.
No, Joshua, I'm really.
There's a significant body of research that shows that it is a matter of perception. People perceive a higher value of something that they have, and they might lose, than they perceive of what you might offer them. And what we've seen is a very good example in the Affordable Care Act. Barack Obama said, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. 1.5 million people approximately lost substandard plans. These are plans that didn't even cover them if they should become ill, have an accident, et cetera, et cetera. They were terrible insurance plans and they got something better. Those people did not go uninsured. They were given a much higher quality plan. Nonetheless, those 1.5 million people became the centerpiece of the opposition to Obamacare, to the Affordable Care Act, and are still held up as the victims, the so-called victims of Obamacare. Now, the basic reality is that there is a certain degree of overpromising in the Conyers healthcare bill. It suggests that they will cover basically almost everything with no out-of-pocket costs. This is something that other countries don't do. And in fact, there are people who have, through their employers, through their unions, have Cadillac healthcare plans, and they would in fact be losing out. And the other thing that I want to point out is that this was not going to happen in a vacuum. Yeah, a lot of single payer proponents say, well, we'll just explain the benefits. I'm happy to stipulate that a single payer program in an ideal world is superior to any combination of public and private coverage that reaches a universal healthcare goal. The problem is that we're not doing this in a vacuum. We will be going up against the same forces that called a little bit of voluntary money for voluntary end of life care death panels.
Right.
And suggested that, faceless government bureaucrats were going to kill your mother. Literally.
And actually, I want Michael to respond to that important point that you made, Joshua, in your article. One of the things you pointed out was that other countries that we do hold up as models of universal healthcare, government provided healthcare, started out spending very little on healthcare to a place where they ended up spending more on healthcare to guarantee coverage. Here in the United States, we're going from a place where we're already spending a huge amount of money, a lot of time has passed. You know, it's, in a way, Michael Joshua, I think, was implying that had we had a system of single-payer healthcare at the same time that we did establish Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, we wouldn't be having these conversations. But to do it now, our opposition is much bigger than it would have been 100 years ago or 50 years ago.
Obviously, this is one of the strawman arguments I think that's raised in the piece, is that no one's claiming we're going to go back to what the Europeans spent. We are instead asserting that we can contain costs and prices specifically going forward through the leverage of single-payer financing. And so we believe that once you can contain those prices, and we saw in California when we studied it, that we could successfully take out a big chunk of the system costs, going from $400 billion down to $331 billion by covering everyone. So that is our template, and we think it is shows that you can do it in the U.S. Not that we're going to get down to the Europeans, but I also think that it's important to understand that when these other systems rely on cost sharing or private insurance, it's nothing like the U.S. These are nonprofit companies that are essentially administrative payers. The rates and benefits are set by the government, and ultimately the government uses its leverage to set, say, prescription drug prices through negotiations. So, and then the cost sharing is also much less because it's a much less expensive system. So, for example, the large employers that Jacob Hacker and Joshua cite in the article as the example of how we need to, the system we need to build on, currently those employers with more than 500 employees are paying $14,000 a year and $4,400 in out-of-pocket expenses. That right there is $18,400 per worker. We in California studied it and can provide healthcare substantially less than that, with comprehensive benefits better actually than what they're currently getting. So we think that the evidence is strongly in favor of this publicly financed approach. And it's not simply a question of them losing what they have, but actually ending co-pays, deductibles, and insurance company premiums is at the heart of the improved Medicare for All proposal. And that right there, never having to deal with an insurance company again, is a very attractive political demand. And even if we think that we can go to Medicare Part E, as Jacob Hacker describes, that is a neoliberal reform. It relies on private insurance. They're the deciders. They decide what we're going to pay for, how long you're in the hospital, and they're telling your doctors and nurses what to do. Instead, we believe that this proposal would be guaranteed health care through public financing with nurses and doctors and clinicians in charge.
So, Joshua, what is your argument against the fact that moving to a Medicare for All system would in fact save so much money? I mean, do you think that a vocal minority who might lose some benefits should be the group that the rest of us should be subservient to? I mean, I have really good healthcare right now through my employer. It's possible my health care might worsen if we move to a Medicare for All system, but should I be the arbiter of that?
I guess I'll say this. I am happy to stipulate that a single payer system is superior. I'm firmly of the belief that if you are talking about the kind of transition, compulsory transition for, again, 70% of the population in a relatively short period of time, and you can extend this to 2 years or 3 years, whatever specifics you want to talk about, you're setting yourself up to fail. I think it's going to be demagogued by the right. I think it's going to get maximal opposition. And I certainly grant that any interim steps are also going to be greeted by opposition. But when you're talking about all healthcare stakeholders fighting for their lives, and then in addition, others exploiting the natural tendency of people to value something that they are holding on to now versus something that they're going to get, I think that we're just setting ourselves up for one of two things. Either we will get Democrats to push this and we will lose that fight, or Democrats will see what I'm saying has some merit to it, and we'll and then we'll have this rift between progressives and Democrats, and there'll be bad faith name calling, et cetera, which we have a lot of now anyway. And what I want to point out is that in my piece, I did not specify a specific path. I did talk about hackers' plan. The point that I really wanted to drive home is we should have an open conversation about different approaches. There are many approaches. I think that Michael is wrong when he says that you can't guarantee healthcare for everyone if you involve the private sector. You can do that. Other countries have done that. Switzerland has 99% coverage. They cover all citizens. They use the private sector. There's nothing that is exclusive between relying on some private coverage and filling in those gaps with public coverage. And one other point that I want to make is that I'm favoring, and I'm going to do a follow-up piece where I talk about this, a much more ambitious public plan, public approach, public heavy approach to filling in the gaps of the current system than the approaches that I'm seeing now. And I think that we need to have that conversation without it being a matter of tribal affinity. If you're a progressive, you got to embrace this plan. If you're an Obama Democrat, you have to embrace this plan. Let's actually have an open discussion about different plans, compare them, contrast them, put them on the table, see what has the best chance of passage. I believe that if you can get, if you can increase your chances of success by a significant amount, by using public healthcare to fill in the gaps in the current system, you are better off than rolling the dice with people's lives for a perfect, ideological ideal.
But Joshua, that's not what we're doing.
One more point.
You know that's not what we're doing, and it's just disingenuous.
Let Michael just make one more point, and then Joshua make one more point. We'll go back to Michael.
Your position, you accuse me of making straw men. I am saying that I did not write the piece as a response to the National Nurses Union. I wrote the piece for rank and file grassroots progressives. So when you say things like it's a straw man because nobody thinks that passing universal health care will bring down costs, that's not true.
That's not what I said. I said you assert in the article that we believe that those supporters of Medicare for All believe that the prices will go down to European levels.
I was not.
You didn't say that.
I didn't say you said that. The article wasn't about you. The article wasn't about healthcare wants. The article was about progressive movement. And if you look at my Twitter feed, there are people who are absolutely believe that it will, without other measures, it will bring costs down very dramatically. Not 1 or 2 percentage points, but very, very dramatically. Things like that. I didn't write the article about healthcare wants in the single payer movement.
No, you're talking about common perceptions. And so that's what I'm reacting to.
Among the grassroots left. Yes, among the...
Yeah, and I just disagree with that. Those aren't the common perceptions.
I want to give Michael a chance to respond.
I think going from $368.5 billion in California to $331 billion, as the Peary study showed for our single-payer bill in California, is a significant savings. It's not down to the European level, but it is a significant savings.
Sure.
And so that's what I'm asserting. And the problem is that when I didn't say that you can't have guaranteed healthcare through the private sector. Much of the healthcare delivery system remains in private hands. The issue is private health insurance in the U.S. is a tax-subsidized failed business model that shouldn't be continued, and the continuation of public financing. Remember, Joshua, 60% nationally and 70% in California of healthcare expenses are paid by taxes. This is a publicly financed system. We're just not getting our money's worth. So continuing to buttress the private insurers in the U.S. is not a route to guaranteed healthcare. And that's what the ACA in part shows. What the difference between the Swiss insurance companies, though Switzerland does have the second highest healthcare costs, among industrialized countries, and that's not a coincidence that they're more private insurance based than other European countries. And those things are correlated. High prices, lots of private insurance. But Because again, what single payer financing does is use the collective leverage of government and a single risk pool, as you know, to lower prices. And until you do that, if you have a multi-tiered system like the Hacker proposal, like these other incremental steps, like the ACA, it's not just multi-tiered in terms of coverage, it's multi-tiered in terms of quality as well. So you have different levels of access, different levels of quality, different levels of benefits. And to perpetrate that, I think reinforces that tribalness and the sectarianness of the whole debate. And so I would reject that. But really the difference with those even the Swiss insurers, the level of regulation and elimination of corporate prerogative that would take to get even to the Swiss system, I would say would generate the same level of political opposition as single payer. And literally that's what we saw in the ACA debate. ACA was characterized as socialized medicine. Literally anything we do will be called single payer by the Republicans. And if we're gonna mount our tactics and strategy just based upon their talking points and how they push back on the ACA or how they're gonna characterize our proposal, I don't think we're approaching it in the right way. This is a prairie fire at the grassroots, this demand for guaranteed health care through an improved Medicare for all. I was just talking to folks in DC. Senate offices get regular calls, not organized, demanding this. It is a prairie fire. We got to build on that, not parse it out with, well, we need to do this incremental thing and we got to do Part E and maybe if we keep the employers and we'll fill the gaps. No, this is an aspirational time for transformative change. And that, I think, is how we're going to best serve this movement and this policy.
Can you guys hear me?
Well, I don't believe that you can. I can hear you
sometimes.
Now.
Okay. So let me ask the both of you to Joshua also. It seems as though, to summarize what's happening, is that there's a reformist approach and a radical approach, and there are arguments to be made on both sides.
I mean, at some point we're going around in circles. I believe that you know, the advantages that you speak of as far as single payer are clearly true. I mean, I'm happy to stipulate that. I've long been a single payer advocate. I think that your a better approach, a more realistic approach. I don't believe that resistance is all equal. For example, if you are asking the entire medical profession to take a significant cut in reimbursements, that's going to be one type of resistance that you could or could not have. You could engender that resistance or not, depending on the path that you take. This is a question of path dependency. I believe that we've already accomplished quite a bit with the Affordable Care Act, despite all of its drawbacks, in that it has not only covered a bunch of people with public health care, set that aside, it has clearly changed the conversation in this country, where you see a dramatic increase in the share of people who say that they believe that healthcare is a human right, they believe that healthcare should be guaranteed by the government. This is in part, and I'm not saying entirely, in part because of the Affordable Care Act. And what you can do is you can deliver and keep delivering, and you create a virtuous cycle. And when you deliver to people, you can then have more credibility next time. So this idea, and you know, I'm not going to convince Michael, he's not going to convince me. I believe, and I'll just say it again, if you bite off more than you can chew in one fell swoop, you know, South Korea developed its single payer healthcare system. And what they did is they did it over a 13-year period. They changed the eligible pool. So they put in one category of worker, then 3 years later, they added another category of worker. At the end of this process, they had a single payer universal healthcare system, but they were paying a fraction of what we're paying. So, I mean, we can go back and forth forever. This is where the difference is. And I hope that people will understand from this conversation that you can be a genuine person of the left who believes very strongly in universal comprehensive healthcare. You don't have to be tied to the healthcare industry. You don't have to be an ideological centrist. You don't have to be part of the establishment to believe that this is a overly risky gamble.
Michael, last thoughts?
The overly risky gamble now is the amount of human suffering and death that occurs from the private insurance industry. And until we eliminate them from the U.S. healthcare system, we're not going to achieve guaranteed healthcare. And it is, the problem is that the ACA is less popular than Medicare. And Medicare is the most popular part of the healthcare system in the U.S., even among Republicans, and it is the one part of the system that really works. The problem in healthcare is about 20% of the patients take 80% of the spending, and much of the spending is at the end of life. And so until you create a single pool with everybody in and nobody out, you're going to have a multi-tiered system where your access to care is determined by your ability to pay. And so, yes, we have to take seriously the transition. Counterexample, Taiwan transitioned much more quickly than South Korea did from an existing system like the U.S. to a single-payer system within a matter of a few years. Again, I think the fact that we do spend so much on healthcare as a percentage of GDP gives us the resources to do a kind of comprehensive program that can eliminate deductibles and copays, doesn't have to rely upon cost sharing, can give people, even in large employers, a better deal. And so I do think, and maybe we have this, maybe it's a semantics distinction, maybe it's a tactical one, that how, you know, what's our demand and what's our program to get there. But what we believe is the best strategy is for to win in a state like California. And we've shown, Joshua, that we can improve the practice environment for physicians, eliminate the 75 grand they spend a year in a typical medical group on administration, and lower their rates to Medicare and still come out pretty close to even. So we can address all these specific impacts at the constituent level through states. And once a big state like California wins it, I think that is the way we can sweep across the country. So we believe that may be an alternative.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. I really appreciate taking the time to do this.
Thanks, Sonali. Thanks for having me. Appreciate that.
Thanks a lot.
My guests have been Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at The Nation Institute. He's also the host of Politics and Reality Radio. And Michael Leite, director of public policy for National Nurses United. We've been debating the progressive push for single-payer health care. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.